Is it time to panic over this Cowboys offense? A look at Dak Prescott and company heading into the Sunday nighter in Philly, plus how the Falcons got hot, whether the Chargers are for real, Derek Carr's future in Oakland, and why everybody loves Nick Mullins. It's all on the MMQB NFL Deep Dive Podcast. Hello and welcome to the MMQB NFL Deep Dive Podcast. I am Gary Gramling. He is Andy Benoit. We have some Week 10 games to discuss, Andy, and we're starting with the Sunday nighter, the NFC East clash. And this is, I think this was the story of the week, now that we sort of moved on from Saints-Rams and people celebrating with cell phones and Aaron Rodgers, Tom Brady, and all that stuff. I feel like the story that most carried through was panic button for Dallas. Cowboys offense, what's wrong with the Cowboys offense? So I will start this discussion, and this is Cowboys at Eagles Sunday night game. What is wrong with the Cowboys offense?
Well, it's the big answer to that's been the same all season long. They're not very good at wide receiver. Now, having Amari Cooper does help. He played well in his debut, but we've discussed on this show, I don't think he changes the entire dynamic, don't tell Chris Stone I said that, the entire dynamic of the receiving core. So I think you start there. The offensive line hasn't played quite as well, but I'm not worried about the O-line. And when you put on their film, you don't think, oh, it's a bad O-line. You just don't see the dominance that you saw a few years ago. But Gary, we might as well save some time. What this discussion is going to come down to is the theoretical conversation of what kind of offense should you build around Dak Prescott. And maybe the question before that is, are you sure Dak Prescott's the long-term answer? Because Jerry Jones brought that up this week, that they're going to extend him, so they're going to build around him. They consulted him on the Cooper trade, I heard. I think we need to start there and all be on the same page. Certainly in Dallas, they need to be on the same page about what they have at quarterback.
Well, what do you think they have at quarterback? Dak Prescott's one of a handful of really interesting quarterback decisions that need to be made. And we've talked on this show quite a bit about how once you give that quarterback a second contract, and if you give a quarterback a second contract, it is a big contract. These guys outside of Tom Brady don't play for discounts. You know, Jameis Winston in Tampa, Derek Carr, you saw it happen with him in Oakland. Marcus Mariota, Titans will have a decision on him. I mean, we have some decisions to be made here, and once you marry one of these guys, you're kind of you're stuck with them, and you're limited with the way you can build around them.
You are, and Prescott to me is what we need to get past this idea that being a game manager that's a pejorative. We need to move on and understand that we're talking style of play when you do that, and I think Dak Prescott can be a really, really high-level game-managing quarterback in a good sense. And part of being a game manager is making the occasional big play. And with him, it's going to be big plays with his legs, throwing off of movement, or just flat-out running. But you've got to have an offense that's conducive to that. The idea that you're just going to have a drop-back passing offense and let Prescott work the field, he's not that kind of passer. He's not that talented of a passer, and he's not that decisive of a passer. He is a smart field general, though, when it's a highly schemed offense, and when you're getting him building off of their running game, which is a little surprising. Their running game has not been more foundational, I guess, this year. If you were to describe it, it's hard to envision what their key running play has been this season. They don't quite have the same identity in their ground game, and that's what's hurting their passing game.
Yeah, they do not. I think if you look at the passing game, if you squint, you can kind of see Michael Gallup, Amari Cooper. That's something for the future right there that you can build along with Dak Prescott at this point. I do think, and look, when teams play in big national games like the Cowboys did on Monday night, and they underachieve and they lose at home to sort of a middling team, although I think Tennessee has a much better defense than they are basically given credit for at this point. But you look at this game, I mean, look, they had Dak threw a bad interception in the red zone. That happens. That takes 7 points off the board. They missed a short field goal. They obviously, you know, late they had to go for a fourth down and turn it over on down. So I don't know if that was necessarily the kind of disastrous, oh my goodness, we need to make wholesale changes type of performance from this offense that everyone sort of treated it as.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. I don't think it was. It just they had some unfortunate, poorly timed, bad moments, and they paid a price for it. But the bigger picture, to me, it still comes down to the wide receiver situation and how are you going to play with those wide receivers. And that becomes a Dak Prescott conversation because he's got to be a tight window thrower to play with those guys. They're not great separators, and he's not a that's not his style of play. He does not have the gunslinger mentality, which is a positive with him, I think, because of the mobility, because of the facilitator nature of his game. So then the question becomes, is that enough? Does that work for you at quarterback? And I think for a lot of teams, Gary, the answer would be no, we need more than that. But in Dallas, where you have Ezekiel Elliott, who is in his prime, and you have an offensive line that, though not as dominant this year as past years, it's got a bunch of superstar guys in their primes. So I think Prescott fits. Remember, just a few years ago when they were that dominant running offense, Prescott looked like the next great thing, his rookie season. I think that's the formula they have to have, and there's just not a whole lot of overlap to their run game and their pass games. You don't feel like you're watching a highly schemed offense when you turn their game on.
Yeah. They go to Philadelphia. Now, a year ago around this time, the Cowboys, it just sort of all fell apart for them. They had the Chaz Green versus Adrian Claiborne game in Atlanta. That was the first of three straight 20-plus point losses for them. The second of those three losses was at home against the Eagles, and this was one where, it really fell apart in the second half. They were up 9-7 at halftime, ended up losing that game 37-9. But when it comes to this Eagles offense, the Eagles defense, it seems like the Cowboys are they're not a great, this is not a great matchup for them. I would think if you're gonna capitalize against this Eagles defense, you basically want to be able to attack them downfield,
right,
where their weakness is. No Rodney McLeod back there, questionable cornerbacks. I don't know if that's the recipe for the Cowboys to win this game on Sunday night.
Yeah, no, I agree with you, but where those corners are most vulnerable is against double moves. And it almost feels like a cliche, like we're saying, I'm jumping on that bandwagon and saying it too. But it's remained true, especially in the case of Jalen Mills. Double moves, Travis Carey, the Browns corner, he was a Raiders corner at the time. He taught me this at training camp when I actually did a drill against him because he demoed on me, Gary. He demonstrated how to do it.
Yeah.
And I almost fell down tripping over myself on walking through it, truly. He was very crafty. But he said, when I said, well, all right, if you're a slow player, if I'm a slow wide receiver, as a cornerback, what's the last thing that you want to see from me? And he said a double move, because that stuff really, the double move doesn't come down to speed. You don't just do one fast move and then another fast move and run by the guy. There's a nuance and a setting it up to it, and it all comes off of a bigger picture, and usually it comes off of a run look. So that stuff is available for Dallas, and Gallup has had some success on that earlier this season, in fact.
Yeah,
so go ahead.
I was going to say, he had a big one against Washington.
Yeah, I'm trying. Thank you. I was trying to remember who it was against. He had a big. It was down the left sideline. I remember.
That was. I want to say it was Fabian Moreau, but I will. I'll try and look it up just in case.
Oh, all right. Wow, full service here. Look at you.
I think could be completely wrong as well. I do know it was the Washington game though.
The point is, Gallup's not a burner though. So it's, you don't need dynamic receivers. Sorry again about saying dynamic. I know I'm not supposed to. You don't need them, though, to run a highly schemed offense and run double moves. Now, what you do need to do is be willing to run the ball, which a lot of teams are not against Philadelphia. And I'm sure Dallas, they should be and they will be, because it's strength on strength, their offensive line versus their defensive line. And you would never back away from your own strength and just to avoid the opponent's strength.
It was, I apologize to Fabian Moreau. It was Greg Stroman, the rookie, who Michael
usually
Gallup
has been lately.
And we should know the Eagles, they're actually going to, they'll probably be without Sidney Jones. They're also probably going to be without Jalen Mills in this one. So you're
is he out this game?
Yeah, you're digging even deeper into that secondary at this point. So,
that's interesting, Gary, because Mills, although he might be, because we just talked about the weakness, and Mills is the guy that Darby's been vulnerable to double moves as well, but Mills is the main guy. So you're replacing him with a lesser corner, but that lesser corner, who do you think it'll be? Maddox plays the slot, so Rasul Douglas probably, maybe? I mean,
yeah,
they've got to figure that out. But that guy might not be as vulnerable to double moves, so which in Dallas's case is not a great thing. They probably, I bet you they wouldn't mind seeing Jalen Mills out there.
Would have preferred to see Mills, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's
I still think you need to be willing to take those shots, though, against Philadelphia, because what you said is exactly right. And even with McLeod out, they're still playing very aggressively with their free safety. They're bringing him down, and he's playing shallow, and it's a three robber is what they call the coverage. It's cover three, but the safety's more of a robber who jumps the middle of the field. No matter who you have at wide receiver, you've got to be willing to attack a defense that plays that aggressively.
All right, let's go to another game here. Let's go Atlanta at Cleveland. Andy, would you please join me on the recommissioning of the Atlanta Falcons bandwagon? This is a team that we all sort of gave up on. Now they won three straight, and now we're kind of rethinking this thing. We talked about this a little bit on Monday. I don't want to get too far ahead of ourselves. They do have a tough schedule down the stretch here to get back into the postseason. But obviously they're going well right now. And a guy we really haven't talked about this season, who we talked a lot about last season, we talked a lot about him back in week one, is Steve Sarkisian. This offense is just, they're clicking much more effectively, and you're seeing a lot more creativity. Yeah. It seems like this year maybe Sarkisian has put a little more of his stamp on this offense with what they're doing.
He's done a nice job. And let's look at their Washington game as an illustration, because they went in and beat a pretty decent team, a team with a very good record on the road in the Washington's building. We talked Sunday night about how the Redskins' run defense has been so good, but it's been more against gap scheme running teams that feature pull blockers and related concepts. And Atlanta is more of an outside zone running team. Well, once I put on the film there, Gary, what the Falcons did in that game was more inside zone running, which is a departure from outside zone, of course. And inside zone, just picture a couple of double teamers at the inside and then someone working up off the double team to the linebacker level. And it was a really good approach by the Falcons, because the Redskins are one of the few teams in the NFL that play what they call an even front, meaning their defensive tackles very often align head up on the guard, as opposed to between the guard and tackle or between the guard and center. They align over men, not in gaps. And those double teams become more effective against an even front sometimes. And I would imagine that's why Atlanta did it. That's good coaching, and that's good adjustment on the fly, and you've got to have the right personnel to be able to do that. An offensive line that's relatively cohesive, a running back and a quarterback that see things the same way, because you're installing a different approach in the ground game on the fly. The other thing they did very well, they killed the Redskins' man coverage with stack releases and bunches and switch releases. All the man beater stuff that we talk about all the time, they did that, and it even worked against some of the Redskins moved to zone coverage on third down later in the game, and this stuff even worked against that. They were very good on third down. Again, highly schemed offense there, but not schemed in a way that you're dependent on it. Let's remember, they got good players too. They have Calvin Ridley, they've got Mohamed Sanu, and they have Julio Jones, and Austin Hooper makes some plays from time to time. So I am very intrigued with the Falcons heading in the second half of the season. What'll be interesting is Cleveland does not have as many defensive tendencies as Washington. So what will that do for their game planning this week?
Yeah, and I almost feel like Cleveland necessarily has to pull back a little bit. I know, if you listen to Myles Garrett's complaints, Cleveland was trying to get a little more ambitious with some of the things they do, and I think they had to pull back a little bit last week with Greg Williams taking over the interim head coaching role there. Not to mention they're going to be missing Denzel Ward in this one, so you figure the Falcons have a pretty significant advantage basically with their weapons against the Browns shorthanded and pretty youthful secondary at this point. One other thing I did want to mention from the Falcons side of this before we get to Browns offense real quick. Bruce Irvin comes in. I mean, he's a guy who I don't think anyone's surprised that the Raiders wanted to move on from him. I guess I was mildly surprised that there was zero interest in him on the trade market. Is he still a guy? Am I crazy, Andy, or is he still a guy who can be sort of a situational handful of snaps a game type of a presence off the edge? If certainly no longer a sort of star number two type of edge rusher like he used to be.
Yeah, and that's what he's been. He's a number two type of edge rusher. His production does not always match his raw talent. I do think it's a good move for Atlanta, though, especially because it gives them the flexibility now to put Tack McKinley inside. And there have been times this year he's played, and whenever he goes inside, it's almost always on the side that Vic Beasley aligns. So they put those two men together. And McKinley at times has shown really good explosiveness as a power rusher inside. I think he's got the power rushing explosiveness on the edge as well. But I would imagine you'll see McKinley inside, and then Beasley has to play outside, and Irvin will play outside. And now you've got that's some firepower in the pass rush. But we're also talking about three talented guys that don't consistently produce. And you still have that issue when you put Atlanta's film on. If they're to go anywhere in the second half of this season, those defensive ends are going to have to be playmakers for them, more consistent playmakers than they've been certainly in the first half of the season.
And Brown side of the ball, we talked about this a little bit on Monday. Baker Mayfield said they had basically scaled back what they were doing offensively. They tried to focus on a handful of plays and concepts that they like and going forward like that. Did you see any difference between what they did in that game against what's a pretty mediocre Chiefs defense?
Yeah, there was a huge difference in that they ran the ball out of base personnel a lot. And I, to be honest, I'm a little surprised they did that. That was the game plan. That's what they did throughout the first half. I'm a little surprised just because my guess is Mayfield is more comfortable out of three receiver sets. That's what they've done most of the season with him, as any team would. But I think especially in his case. But then against their opponent last week, Kansas City has struggled in run defense against three receiver sets. We talk about that all the time. They're a better run defense in base. So the Browns tried to line up and just smash mouth. And they had okay results here and there. They did some nice things with slant flat route combinations to the boundary. So just one guy running to the flat and the slant creating a natural rub. That was obviously the passing concept they were most comfortable with. So they obviously scaled it back. Jury's still out. We have to see. I mean, it's scaling it back and then there's going rudimentary. And I think you got to find the happy balance between those two.
All right, let's go. Let's go with Chargers at Oakland. This is a Chargers team that we haven't really revisited in a little while, but they have a 5-game win streak going here. I don't know. What's your sense overall of this team at this point, Andy? Before we drill in on some of the specifics here, is this team better than it was a year ago, or are we going to see a repeat of last year where they kind of they do have a tough schedule down the stretch here? This is not part of that tough schedule, but they still have to go to Pittsburgh, they have to go to Kansas City. Is this sort of a the analogy I always use is the quad A hitter in baseball, the guy who can hammer sort of the triple A minor league pitching, but when he gets to the majors can't quite handle the best of the best? Is that what this Chargers team is going to end up being again this season?
Everybody says so because that's what they've been before, but I don't think what they've been before carries as much weight as what others would think, and I could be wrong about that. I like the way they're pieced together. Their offensive line's better than people realize, which allows them to run their entire playbook. They've found their run game identity. Melvin Gordon on gap scheme runs. He's very good at setting up man-to-man blocks. We know what Phillip Rivers can do, and he's got a bunch of really big athletically gifted targets both outside and inside. So it's an offense that can score 30 points any given week, and they didn't do that against Seattle. They actually were not great against Seattle, and they still got the win because I think their defense is a tick better than it was a year ago. What I'm really interested to see, and we don't know if Joey Bosa is going to get back for one, and that could influence what I'm about to say here, but I want to see what they do with Derwin James in the second half of the season. He's a box safety right now. They blitzed him early in the year. Nobody had an answer for him. That's not their identity in Los Angeles. They're not a big blitzing team, although Gus Bradley has expanded their schemes over the last year and a half. I think you have to be that kind of defense. At least you have to be willing to sprinkle it in 8 to 12 times a game if you have Derwin James. And that, to me, is the X factor. I don't think they're good enough to just line up and play. I think they need to make teams fear them schematically, and James is the guy to do that with.
Would you envision a Gus Bradley defense doing that? I mean, that seems to be pretty far away from his MO over the years.
Yeah, it is, but I think he's drifting away from his MO in a healthy way. I think they have they've shown this stuff. That's why I know, that's how we know James is so good at it, because they did it early in the season and James is an absolute monster. They didn't, and look, maybe it was a function last week. They played Seattle, which is a run-based offense, the most run-based offense in the NFL, in fact. Maybe that's part of it, although I would think you'd be even more willing to blitz your big strong safety in the run game. So I want to see what they do. I would be more versatile with Derwin James and try to become more of a playmaking defense if I were them.
Yeah, I was going to say on the offensive side of the ball. I mean, you know, they gosh, the run game is just dominant this year with Gordon and then Austin Eckler sprinkled in here. But you look at that passing game, we kind of wonder what was going to happen. You know, no Hunter Henry. They did bring back Antonio Gates, obviously, but he's not what he was 3 or 4 years ago. But between Keenan Allen and then those two guys, the Williams, Mike Williams and Tyrell Williams, I mean, when everyone's focused on Allen and you get one of those Williamses downfield is like a 6'4 mismatch target. I mean, they are turning in a ton of big plays this year.
Absolutely. And I think Mike is better inside and Tyrell's better outside. Gates now plays on third down passing situations. Last week, there were still times where he drew the double team. Now, that's usually on third and short because he's such a good underneath receiver at this point. But defenses still respect him within the context. He's very good within the context of LA's scheme. So that's part of it. But they have guys that win 50-50 balls, like you just said, the Williams guys. And then Eckler, and we haven't even talked about Travis Benjamin. Eckler's gotten so good that he's wedged Benjamin out. But they've got the ability to go horizontal on you and quickly get the ball in the perimeter, like in a receiver screen. They're very good there as well. This is a high-pedigreed offense. And the guy running it, do you think Phillip Rivers – I don't think he'll be thought of this way – but do you think there's a legitimate discussion to be had? Let's say his career ended tomorrow. Is he the best QB to never have won a Super Bowl? Or is it still Dan Marino's title?
No, it has to be Marino.
You think
but
so?
But Rivers is up there. Do you put – I think we've discussed this before, but obviously time has passed and things have happened since then. Do you put Phillip Rivers in the Hall of Fame?
Oh, yeah. Yes. Yeah. When he's done, he's going to have top five all-time passing numbers. Top five. So think about that. Top five.
Yeah. No, I
agree. It's like
the
Frank Gore
fully.
Discussion. Frank Gore is going to be the fourth leading rusher of all time when he's done. That to me, that's default Hall of Fame.
Yeah. I'm with you on that. Someone, by the way, it's not in the mailbag this week. Someone did ask about Frank Gore and why Frank Gore doesn't get enough press at this point. I think the only reason he hasn't gotten enough press recently is because he's played on some, pretty. I don't want to say the Dolphins are a bad team this year. Certainly, it's not an exciting offense they're running. And then he was on a bad Colts team last year. So
let's be honest. Everybody loves Frank Gore, but he's not a great interview. And I think he would even tell. Remember, we've heard stories where we've had people on staff interview him and. They say, you don't have to run if you don't want to, because he just isn't. It just doesn't.
Yeah.
He's not a great quote. That's why he doesn't get the press.
Yeah. He should have some hotter takes. Then we'd talk about him more.
Reason I'm sharing that, by the way, is because the PR staff that told us that said Frank doesn't care. He's cool with it.
Yeah. The last thing I wanted to mention from this game, obviously the Raiders are looking ahead at this point. What do you make of Derek Carr at this point, though?
In regards to what? Like, how is he now, or are we talking, is he the guy?
In regards to, obviously the trade deadline has passed, so he's not going anywhere at this point. This offseason, if the Raiders wanted to shop Derek Carr, one, would there be interest? And I guess two, would that be foolish?
I think it would be foolish. I think there would be interest. Derek Carr has a great quick release. He's a compact thrower. He's run different types of offenses. He's been pretty expansive in it. He can work at the line of scrimmage, and he's mobile. If Derek Carr were entering the draft next year, he'd be a surefire first-round pick. The only complication, it's a big one, though, is the contract, and is he worth as much money as his contract calls for?
Yep.
But there are a lot, yeah, but there are a lot of teams that are willing to live with that at quarterback. Quarterbacks cost what they cost, ultimately.
All right, that's gonna be a discussion.
Do you think he'll be a Raider? Yeah, do you think he'll be a Raider next year at this time?
Boy, it's tough. We've got to sort out the draft class first. There's so many teams who are going to be obviously bad teams don't have quarterbacks often. So there's going to be teams looking at this quarterback class. It's not a quarterback class like last year in that I think everyone was fairly comfortable saying those four guys were top half of the first round picks. There's a group of quarterbacks. I think there could be four or five go in the first round, but I don't know if you look at any of them and say, like, oh yeah, this is the guy who's top 10. It's going to be one of those things where one or two of them will go top 10, but I don't know who you would look at and say this is a top 10 pick.
And let's also remember the Carr contract. We think of it that we think it's huge because at the time it was, but a lot has happened since he signed that deal. Kirk Cousins, for example, his cap hit in 2019 is going to be $29 million, and the cash out of the contract for him is $28 million. That's a lot of millions. Derek Carr's cap hit in 2019 is going to be $22.5 million with about $20 million in cash involved. That's a huge difference. That's two-thirds of what Cousins cost. So yeah. Carr is not the expenditure now that that we think of because the market has changed since he signed his deal.
And that, you know, what would help is if that offensive line blocks someone. That would be helpful.
Yeah,
they should get that sorted out.
Their tackles are terrible. They're playing terribly. And their interior line is having the worst season that it's had, and it's a pretty good group. Osemele, who actually has had some nice snaps, Rodney Hudson, who's been pretty good, and Gabe Jackson at right guard. But collectively, it's been inconsistent. It's not a good situation in the O-line there right now, and I don't think it's just the players.
Yeah, if you're wondering about Andy's cryptic comment, you can check out this week's deep dive column. Go about two-thirds of the way down. Let's go one more game here.
Read the front of it first. Don't just skip down two-thirds. Read what I have to say. Come on now.
Yeah, read what Andy has to say, but don't give up when don't think you've missed it or something in the first half where he's talking about it was about non-quarterback MVPs this year. Maybe when people think they see no Raiders offensive linemen in that top 10, they'll be upset.
That's fair.
Or no, yeah, they'll think that's what you're referring to.
Yep, I got sensitive. You're right.
Let's go to the Monday night game. This is the Nick Mullen show coming up. This is Giants at 49ers. Obviously, it's not a great game here, but Nick Mullen's is, I guess, worth the... Well, it's free to watch it if you have cable, so there is no price of admission. But Nick Mullens is worth your time if you want to spend some time with this game. Obviously, you know, look, he put up impressive and efficient numbers against a Raiders defense that, as we've talked about, is not terribly talented. What was your first impression of Nick Mullens here, Andy?
My first impression was I love the offense he's playing in. I love the way they help out their quarterback. I love how they use Kyle Juszczyk, who's the most valuable fullback I've seen in a very long time. George Kittle, I love the way they play out of base personnel, their fullbacks, their running backs, their tight ends. And it's extremely user-friendly. And look, Mullens responded well to that. But if you think that we've just stumbled into this hidden gem of a superstar, we don't know that yet. The jury is they haven't even left the courtroom yet. The 12th juror is filing out the door right now. So we're a long ways off. I do like, as a thrower, I do like Nick Mullens' motion. He's kind of got that Derek Carr thing we just talked about, the quick, snappy, efficient release, and that's a big deal. That's what Garoppolo has. I imagine that's something Shanahan really values, and that might even be why Mullens is on the roster. So I see why people are excited, but let's not – It was just one game against a very bad defense on a short week and a very well-schemed offense. Let's keep it at that for right now.
Fair enough. It was also on national TV, and he had a nice moment with the emotional interview afterwards. So,
yeah, and people like, and I appreciate that he cares. I mean, that's pretty cool. The ratings, what did you see the ratings for that game? Because I was eager to check them because I figured, okay, this will tell us the baseline for an NFL game. Whatever the minimum that an NFL game is likely to get, at least on a Thursday, this will probably be near it. Although the Raiders and Niners are both kind of national brands, so it's probably a little bit more than an AFC South baseline game. But did you see what the ratings were?
I did not see the ratings, but I would, before you tell us, I would have guessed the previous week's game, the Dolphins at Texans, would have gotten lower ratings.
You think so? I mean, even with Deshaun Watson and J.J. Watt, and then the Raiders and Niners come in with two wins between them?
Well, now I'm trying to think. The team brands are better in the second one. You do have a lot of people who play fantasy and have Deshaun Watson and DeAndre Hopkins. I don't know if there was a single player in that 49ers-Raiders game who anyone would have played in a fantasy league. Maybe George Kittle, that's about it.
This game was a blowout, too. That impacts the way they measure the ratings.
Yes,
that impacts
that's
it, too.
That's true. But what
right,
was, the, what
rating
was the rating
for the game? It was an 8.2.
I don't know. I don't know. What, give me the context here, Andy.
What do you mean the context?
Is that surprisingly good? What is that compared to the other
Thursday night game? That's higher than I would have guessed. I would have thought it'd be a 6.
Yeah? All right.
I don't know. What Patriots-Packers the other night was like a 15.8 or something. It was almost a 16, I think, if I am not mistaken. I was surprised. I was pleasantly surprised. Now, it did not outdraw the Big Bang Theory, which is a great commentary on our country, but it came close. And usually Thursday Night Football does win.
I will say this is one of the few times where, Big Bang Theory is not for me, but if it's for you, I don't think this football game is going to pull you away on Thursday night.
What do you think the Monday night ratings will be then? Giants are a bigger brand, but I think people who aren't Giants fans probably are sick of them. They're boring if you're not a Giants fan. And it's ESPN. It's not Fox.
ESPN, not Fox. I'm having trouble doing this, Andy, without the context of having the spreadsheet in front of me with the rest of the Monday night ratings on it. I will say the Monday night game will do. People want to watch Beckham. People want to watch Saquon. So I'll say that it'll do like a slightly more than what Niners Raiders did on a Thursday night.
And I will take slightly less, and we will bet one year's salary on it, like we always do.
All right. That spreadsheet I should have somewhere. See how many millions you owe me at this point. You did. You've won a couple back, though, so we're getting close to even. Last thing before we open the mini mailbag, Dez Bryant is a member of the New Orleans Saints. Andy, you've said... I'll say you've literally said Dez Bryant is kind of done. He's
can't a number
really
four.
Play anymore.
He's a number four wide receiver. He'll replace Cameron Meredith. He might get number three snaps because in their offense there's room for that. They don't ask the same thing of their slot guys because they have Alvin Kamara and they have Michael Thomas. I am blown away. I guess I'm not, but I the number of people that are treating this like it's Dez Bryant 2014 signing with the Saints. Do you really think if Dez Bryant could still play, he was just sitting out there waiting to be signed in early November by somebody? I can't believe how many people are treating this as anything other than a very small move by the Saints, which is what it is.
I'm treating it that way. So I don't have a great answer for you. He's a name. He played in a very popular market for a very popular team. That's all I got.
And he doesn't run well anymore, which he does fit their system. I'm not saying, I mean, I guess I'm saying he can't play if you think that's what you're getting. If you think this is a big Super Bowl type of move for the, it's not that. It's not even remotely close to that. There are no big Super Bowl moves left. The trade deadline's over, and the guys who are any good are all on rosters. There's nobody sitting out there is going to make a difference off a street free agency now. So this is just filling in the blanks. Cameron Meredith really doesn't run very well anymore either. He looks slow and sluggish. He's had some knee problems, so they're finding someone else. Another guy who's slow and sluggish, but they're hoping a little better at it.
Yeah. Slow and sluggish. That's the strategy with those sub-package receivers in New Orleans. Andy, we got a couple mailbag questions here, which we neglected a week ago because we had the trade deadline special. This first one is specifically for me. This is from Greg on Twitter. Gary, would you explain more about your love fest with Dirk Cutter on the podcast? As a Falcons fan, I don't have fond memories of him playing Steven Jackson over Devontae Freeman and his unimaginative offense in general. He seems very rigid in his approach. I'll concede a bit of that, although I think they are built to do what they do offensively, which is throw the ball downfield, and that complements sort of an old school power running game that they have there in Tampa. So I think he has built the proper offense for the talent in Tampa at this point, and I think if the quarterbacking was a little more consistent, you would get better results. The main reason I like Dirk Cutter, and Andy, you can weigh in after this. We go out on the road and we get a sense of what's going on at training camps and that sort of thing. The reports that always come back from Tampa is just that Dirk Cutter is organized. He is on the ball. He knows what he is doing in that sort of, that needed CEO role that a head coach needs to fill as sort of the organizational leader for his team. And that's what our people have come away very impressed with. There is a coach who perhaps ran a team in the NFC East here in the Northeast, who may have lost his job in the past calendar year, who I remember people coming back and saying, that didn't look so good. But everyone seems to be quite impressed with what Dirk Cutter does from a leadership standpoint and from an organizational standpoint, the way he runs that team. I think they have the right offense. That's his forte. I think their defense is the issue there. And I don't know how much you can put on him. Maybe he should have pulled the plug on Mike Smith earlier. They do have a relationship, so that was a difficult decision. But I like him. That's it. I think he's a good coach.
Yeah, I think he understands the politics of being a head coach. And I mean that as a compliment, because those politics are real. Dealing with the media is real. Dealing with ownership, all of it is true. And you have to be able to handle it. And if you can't, you're not going to last no matter how good of a football guy you are, and we've seen that happen to other men. So, I like his scheme as well. I've liked it more in past years than this year, if I'm being honest. But it's not. John DeFilippo said this to me once, Gary, the Vikings offensive coordinator, because I was peppering him with questions about this play and that play and how you're going to do this. And he said, Andy, plays are just plays. Everybody's got plays and they all work on paper. You don't draw them up to not work. It's the way you teach them and the way you approach the job. And I like his scheme, but I like everybody. As long as you have an identity and there's a consistency to how you play, theoretically, just about every scheme has its merits. So I think Cutter passes that test.
Yeah, and the last thing I'll just comment on Greg's question here. The playing Steven Jackson over Devontae Freeman. I don't get too worked up about that. I think especially when it comes to a veteran and a young player, sometimes it's just a case of, this guy is a complimentary player and we trust the veteran more than the young guy. And certainly we've seen over the years, and I won't bring up the horrible memories that Atlanta fans might have of that certain game a couple of winters ago. But, Devontae Freeman is not the most consistent guy when it comes to pass protection. That might have played into it. Sometimes you have a proven guy who you know what he's going to do, you know what he's giving you, and sometimes that earns him, you know, basically more playing time over a more talented younger player. And I think it happens with every coach everywhere, and I think it's tough to get on a guy for that. I mean, Bill Belichick played the Patriots gave Drew Bledsoe a 10-year, $100 million contract the year before he got hurt, which tells you they were not going to go to Tom Brady anytime soon, even though Tom Brady ended up being the greatest quarterback of all time. I don't think that makes you think any less of Bill Belichick as a coach because of that decision, but that's my
take. The first conversation I ever had with Cutter, and this sealed our positive relationship, and I've learned a lot of football from him. I asked him at the time, he has him now on the roster again, Jacquizz Rodgers. This is when Cutter was the offensive coordinator in Atlanta, and a lot of people were saying Jacquizz Rodgers should play more. He was dynamic again. I did it at the front of the show and the end of the show. But he was a little jitterbug out there. He could really move and make people miss. And I said, why doesn't Jacquizz Rodgers play more? And he had this kind of a wry smile, and he said, you think he should play more? And I said, no, because you're choosing not to play him, and the coaches know their players better than anybody on the outside does. So there's obviously a reason he's not on the field. And Cutter, I think he stood up out of his chair, Gary. He was so impressed with my wisdom at that moment. He was euphoric about that, though, because we forget that. These coaches that decide we're playing Steven Jackson over Devontae Freeman, they're in the meeting rooms every day with those guys. They've got infinitely more information than we do. So instead of wondering why isn't a guy, you can wonder why isn't he playing more, but that's what you should do, is wonder why isn't he playing more, rather than banging the tables and saying he should play more, which is not to say coaches are flawless either. Dennis Allen the other night. Yeah, because remember, did you hear the Sunday night game? Dennis Allen, the Vikings Saints, their D coordinator for the Saints, admitted to the Sunday night crew, yeah, we probably should play Marcus Davenport more at defensive end. Sometimes as coaches, you fall in love with the guy who knows what he's doing, and you don't give the guy who maybe doesn't a chance to develop. So it's real, but that's for Dennis Allen to say. That's not for us to say.
Yeah. No, look, it's a... I don't want to say it's a fair criticism, because that's kind of the opposite of what we're saying at this point, but it's fair to be skeptical, but you have to understand that the guys making the decision generally have more information. Doesn't mean they're right all the time. It just there are reasons. No one looks at a guy and says that guy would make our team better, but we're going to keep him on the bench. That was a terrible summation of this whole conversation, but that will give us a chance to move on to the next question. This is Rafael from Brazil. What do you guys think is the best scenario for a successful NFL team in the postseason, being in a very strong division like the NFC South, or being way above the other teams in the division like the Patriots and the Rams? Seeing the Saints' brutal remaining schedule, I get the feeling they'll either be really banged up by the end of the regular season or steamrolling everyone after surviving a stretch with games against the Eagles, Falcons, Steelers, and Panthers twice. I think this has been something of an advantage for the Patriots over the years, in the way that they kind of treat the season as a process, and we're gonna get better as the year goes on. I think they have that leeway built in because of the division they've been in, the fact that they just haven't had competitive teams in that division. They've gone in pretty confident that they can play with two or three games and still win the AFC East. That's my thought on it.
Yeah, I don't get into this whole schedule, strength of schedule thing. I'm not saying it's not real, but like that question to me, and I it's a good question, but the question to me about, well, are they beating up on bad teams? Will they be ready? Are they grinding out wins? What does that mean for the playoffs? That to me is more of an NBA question, where basketball is a fluid game and it's not as scheme driven and it's not as game plan driven. Football is such a tactical sport. I think each week is its own game, and I think the strength of schedule in the NFL, when you get to that level, gets overblown because of that. So I don't know how to answer that Saints question.
Well. Didn't I say on the Monday podcast that I don't want the bye week?
What do you mean you don't want the bye week? Oh, yeah, I don't want the bye week. I would take the bye week in the playoffs. Why would you not want the bye week? You get if you're going to win the Super Bowl, you're going to have to win off a bye week. So why would you not take the free playoff win? I know that rust and rhythm type of thing. I think that gets overblown as well.
I can't remember why I said it. I'll stick with it, though, because I can't back down now.
No, that would make you a coward, and we don't do that in media in America. That's not how America media works.
I will just say I thought we had a really weird show on Monday morning, and I think it was because of the time change, the daylight savings.
Yeah.
I
told you how much I love, and I still love it, because what happens now is it feels like it's late, and I put on another side of the ball, or I get done watching a side of the ball on film, and oh man, I don't have time for another one. And it's still early. It just feels late. I think this daylight savings thing is just extraordinary. I went on and on about it last week, though.
Yeah, no, I listened to the show on Monday, and I was like, God, why was I saying these things? What was going on?
Oh yeah, I did think you struggled with it. Yeah, no, yeah. For sure.
Right. I will do better when we tape Sunday night for the Monday morning NFL podcast. So please join us then. For now, that's a wrap for this deep dive show. Thanks to our researchers Reed Foster and Ryan Taylor, who make us sound smart, and thank you as always to producer Shelby Royston and the guys at Cadence 13 who make us sound good every time we do one of these shows. Most of all, thank you to you guys for listening to this episode of the MMQB NFL Deep Dive Podcast. You are the best. Andy and I will be back in your feed first thing Monday morning to break down on the Sunday action. I will be back on Friday as well, joining Jimmy Traina and Scott Gramling on the MMQB Gambling Show, if that's your thing. Or you can go one back in your feed, and then you'll get Jenny Brentis and Connor Orr joining Albert Breer to break down the biggest news from around the league. We humbly ask that you subscribe to the MMQB Podcast Network wherever you listen to podcasts, including the MMQB.com, SI.com, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, TuneIn, and other podcast providers. We will see you guys Monday morning.
Tip of the hat to Albert, another strong edition of MMQB. Did you know your favorite team has a daily podcast on the Locked On Podcast Network? Steelers fans, we have you covered with Locked On Steelers. Cowboys fans, it's Locked On Cowboys. And Chiefs fans, it's Locked On Chiefs. You get the picture. Search Locked On, your favorite team. Search on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts for Locked On, your favorite team. Or tell your smart speaker to play podcasts Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.